This is Audible.
Recorded books and one-click digital present Breath, Eyes, Memory by Edwige Dantica. Narrated by Robin Miles. Part 1. Chapter 1. A flattened and drying daffodil was dangling off the little card that I had made my Aunt Attie for Mother's Day. I pressed my palm over the flower and squashed it against the plain beige cardboard. When I turned the corner near the house, I saw her sitting in an old rocker in the yard, staring at a group of children crushing dried yellow leaves into the ground. The leaves had been left in the sun to dry. They would be burned that night at the Combeet potluck dinner. I put the card back in my pocket before I got to the yard. When Tante Attie saw me, she raised the piece of white cloth she was embroidering and waved it at me. When I stood in front of her, she opened her arms just wide enough for my body to fit into them.
"How was school?"
she asked with a big smile. She bent down and kissed my forehead, then pulled me down onto her lap. "School was all right," I said. "I like everything but those reading classes they let parents come to in the afternoon. Everybody's parents come except you. I never have anyone to read with, so Monsieur Augustin always pairs me off with an old lady who wants to learn her letters, but does not have children at the school."
"I do not want a pack of children teaching me how to read," she said. "The young should learn from the old, not the other way. Besides, I have work."
A blush of embarrassment rose to her brown cheeks.
"But one time, I would have given anything to be in school. But not at my age. My time is gone. Cooking and cleaning, looking after others, that's my school now. That schoolhouse is your school. Cutting cane was the only thing for a young one to do when I was your age. That is why I never want to hear you complain about your school."
She adjusted a pink head rag wrapped tightly around her head and dashed off a quick smile, revealing two missing side teeth.
"As long as you do not have to work in the fields, it does not matter that I will never learn to read that ragged old Bible under my pillow."
Whenever she was sad, Tante Attie would talk about the sugarcane fields, where she and my mother practically lived when they were children. They saw people die there from sunstroke every day. Tante Attie said that one day, while they were all working together, her father, my grandfather, stopped to wipe his forehead, leaned forward, and died. My grandmother took the body in her arms and tried to scream the life back into it. They all kept screaming and hollering as my grandmother's tears bathed the corpse's face. Nothing would bring my grandfather back. The bolette man was coming up the road. He was tall and yellow like an amber roach. The children across the road lined up by the fence to watch him, clutching one another as he whistled and strolled past them. This albino, whose name was Chabin, was the biggest lottery agent in the village. He was thought to have certain gifts that had nothing to do with the lottery, but which Tante Attie believed put the spirits on his side. For example, if anyone was chasing him, he could turn into a snake with one flip of his tongue. Sometimes he could see the future by looking into your eyes, unless you closed your soul to him by thinking of a religious song and prayer while in his presence. I could tell that Tante Attie was thinking of one of her favorite verses as he approached. "Death is the shepherd of man, and in the final dawn, good will be the master of evil."
"On est, mes belles, Attie, Sophie?"
Chabin winked at us from the front gate. He had no eyelashes, or seemed to have none. His eyebrows were tawny and fine like corn silk, but he had a thick head of dirty red hair.
"How are you today?"
he asked.
"Today we are fine," Tante Attie said. "We do not know about tomorrow."
"Qui numéro today?"
he asked.
"What numbers you playing?"
Today we play my sister Martine's age, Tante T said. Sophie's mother's age, 31. Perhaps it will bring me luck.
31 will cost you 50 cents, he said.
Tante T reached into her bra and pulled out one gourd.
We will play the number twice, she said.
Even though Tante T played faithfully, she had never won at the boulette. Not even a small amount, not even once. She said the lottery was like love. Providence was not with her, but she was patient. The albino wrote us a receipt with the numbers and the amount Tante T had given him. The children cringed behind the gate as he went on his way. Tante T raised her receipt towards the sun to see it better. There, he wrote your name, I said, pointing to the letters. And there, he wrote the number 31. She ran her fingers over the numbers as though they were quilted on the paper.
Would it not be wonderful to read? I said, for what must have been the 100th time. I tell you my time is past. School is not for people my age.
The children across the street were piling up the leaves in Madame Augustin's yard. The bigger ones waited on line as the smaller ones dropped onto the pile, bouncing to their feet, shrieking and laughing. They called one another's names. Foi, hope,
faith, espérance,
beloved, God-given, my joy, firstborn, lastborn,
assez filles, enough girls, enough boys,
deliverance, small misery, big misery, no misery. Names as bright and colorful as the giant poinsettias in Madame Augustin's garden. They grabbed one another and fell to the ground, rejoicing as though they had flown past the towering flame trees that shielded the yard from the hot Haitian sun.
You think these children would be kind to their mothers and clean up those leaves?
Tante T said.
Instead, they are making a bigger mess.
They should know better, I said, secretly wishing that I, too, could swim in their sea of dry leaves. Tante T threw her arms around me and squeezed me so hard that the lemon-scented perfume which she dabbed across her chest each morning began to tickle my nose.
Sunday is Mother's Day, no?
She said, loudly sucking her teeth.
The young ones, they should show their mothers they want to help them. What you see in your children today, it tells you about what they will do for you when you are close to their grave.
I appreciated Tante T, but maybe I did not show it enough. Maybe she wanted to be a real mother, have a real daughter to wear matching clothes with, hold hands and learn to read with. Mother's Day will make you sad, won't it, Tante T?
Why do you say that?
She asked. You look like someone who is going to be sad.
You were always wise beyond your years. Just like your mother.
She gently held my waist as I climbed down from her lap. Then she cupped her face in both palms, her elbows digging into the pleats of her pink skirt. I was going to sneak the card under her pillow Saturday night so that she would find it as she was making the bed on Sunday morning. But the way her face drooped into her palms made me want to give it to her right then. I dug into my pocket and handed it to her. Inside was a poem that I had written for her. She took the card from my hand. The flower nearly fell off. She pressed the tape against the short stem, forced the baby daffodil back in its place, and handed the card back to me. She did not even look inside.
Not this year, she said.
Why not this year?
Sophie, it is not mine. It is your mother's. We must send it to your mother.
I only knew my mother from the picture on the night table by Tante T's pillow. She waved from inside the frame, with a wide grin on her face and a large flower in her hair. She witnessed everything that went on in the house, each step, each stumble, each hug and kiss. She saw us when we got up, when we went to sleep, when we laughed, when we got upset at each other. Her expression never changed. Her grin never went away. I sometimes saw my mother in my dreams. She would chase me through a field of wild flowers as tall as the sky. When she caught me, she would try to squeeze me into the small frame so that I could be in the picture with her. I would scream and scream until my voice gave out. Then Tante T would come and save me from her grasp. I slipped the card back in my pocket and got up to go inside. Tante T lowered her head and covered her face with her hands. Her fingers muffled her voice as she spoke.
When I am done feeling bad, I will come in and we will find you a very nice envelope for your card. Maybe it will get to your mother after the fact, but she will welcome it because it will come directly from you.
It is your card, I insisted.
It is for a mother, your mother.
She motioned me away with a wave of her hand.
When it is Aunt's day, you can make me one.
Will you let me read it to you?
It is not for me to hear, my angel. It is for your mother.
I plucked out the flower and dropped it under my shoes. Then I put the card back in my pocket. Across the road, the children were yelling each other's names, inviting passing friends to join them. They sat in a circle and shot the crackling leaves high above their heads. The leaves landed on their faces and clung to their hair. It was almost as though they were caught in a rain of daffodils. I continued to watch the children as Tante T prepared what she was bringing to the potluck. She put the last touches on a large tray of sweet potato pudding that filled the whole house with its molasses scent. As soon as the sun set, lamps were lit all over our quarter. The small children sat playing marbles near whatever light they could find. The older boys huddled in small groups near the schoolyard fence as they chatted over their books. The girls formed circles around their grandmother's feet, learning to sew. Tante T had promised that in another year or so, she would teach me how to sew.
You should not stare,
she said as we passed a nearsighted old woman whispering mystical secrets of needle and thread to a little girl. The girl was squinting as her eyes dashed back and forth to keep up with the movements of her grandmother's old fingers. Can I start sewing soon? I asked Tante T.
Soon as I have a little time, she said.
She put her hand on my shoulder and bent down to kiss my cheek.
Is something troubling you? I asked. Don't let my troubles upset you, she said.
When I made the card, I thought it would make you happy. I did not mean to make you sad.
You have never done anything to make me sad, she said. That is why this whole thing is going to be so hard.
A cool evening breeze circled the dust around our feet.
You should put on your blouse with the long sleeves, she said, so you don't catch cold.
I wanted to ask her what was going to be so hard, but she pressed her finger over my lips and pointed towards the house. She said,
go.
And so I went. One by one, the men began to file out of their houses. Some carried plantains, others large Negro yams, which made your body itch if you touched them raw. There were no men in Tante T's and my house, so we carried the food ourselves to the yard where the children had been playing. The women entered the yard with tins of steaming ginger tea and baskets of cassava bread. Tante T and I sat near the gate, she behind the women and me behind the girls. Monsieur Augustin stacked some twigs with a rusty pitchfork and dropped his ripe plantains and husked corn on the pile. He lit a long match and dropped it on the top of the heap. The flame spread from twig to twig until they all blended into a large smoky fire. Monsieur Augustin's wife began to pass around large cups of ginger tea. The men broke down into small groups and strolled down the garden path, smoking their pipes. Old tantes, aunties, and grandmothers swayed, cooing babies on their laps. The teenage boys and girls drifted to dark corners, hidden by the shadows of rustling banana leaves. Tante T said that the way these potlucks started was really a long time ago in the hills. Back then, a whole village would get together and clear a field for planting. The group would take turns clearing each person's land until all the land in the village was cleared and planted. The women would cook large amounts of food while the men worked. Then, at sunset, when the work was done, everyone would gather together and enjoy a feast of eating, dancing, and laughter. Here in Croix des Rosettes, most of the people were city workers who labored like Tante T in baseball or clothing factories and lived in small, cramped houses to support their families back in the provinces. Tante T said that we were lucky to live in a house as big as ours, with a living room to receive our guests, plus a room for the two of us to sleep in. Tante T said that only people living on New York money or people with professions like Monsieur Augustin could afford to live in a house where they did not have to share a yard with a pack of other people. The others had to live in huts, shacks, or one-room houses that sometimes they had to build themselves. In spite of where they might live, this potluck was open to everybody who wanted to come. There was no field to plant, but the workers used their friendships in the factories or their grouping in the shared houses as a reason to get together, eat, and celebrate life. Tante T kept looking at Madame Augustin as she passed the tea to each person in the women's circle around us.
"How is Martine?"
Madame Augustin handed Tante T a cup of steaming tea. Tante T's hand jerked, and the tea sprinkled the back of Madame Augustin's hand.
"I saw the facteur bring you something big yesterday."
Madame Augustin blew into her tea as she spoke.
"Did your sister send you a gift?"
Tante T tried to ignore the question.
"Was it a gift?" insisted Madame Augustin. "It is not the child's birthday again, is it? She was just 12, no less than 2 months ago."
I wondered why Tante T had not showed me the big package. Usually, my mother would send us 2 cassettes with our regular money allowance. 1 cassette would be for me and Tante T, the other for my grandmother. Usually, Tante T and I would listen to our cassette together. Maybe she was saving it for later. I tried to listen without looking directly at the women's faces. That would have been disrespectful, as bad as speaking without being spoken to.
"How is Martine doing over there?"
asked Stéphane, the albino's wife. She was a sequins piece worker who made herself hats from leftover factory sequins. That night she was wearing a gold bonnet that made her look like a star had landed on her head.
"My sister is fine, thank you,"
Tante T finally answered. Madame Augustin took a sip of her tea and looked over at me. She gave me a reprimanding look that said, "Why aren't you playing with the other children?" I quickly lowered my eyes, pretending to be studying some random pebbles on the ground.
"I would wager that it is very nice over there in New York,"
Madame Augustin said.
"I suppose it could be," said Tante T. "Why have you never gone?" asked Madame Augustin. "Perhaps it is not yet the time," said Tante T. "Perhaps it is," corrected Madame Augustin.
She leaned over Tante T's shoulder and whispered in a not-so-low voice,
"When are you going to tell us at tea when the car comes to take you to the airplane?"
"Is Martine sending for you?" asked the albino's wife. Suddenly, all the women began to buzz with questions.
"When are you leaving? Can it really be as sudden as that? Will you marry there? Will you remember us?"
"I am not going anywhere,"
Tontati interrupted.
I have it on good information that it was a plane ticket that you received, said Madame Augustin. If you are not going, then who was the plane ticket for?
All their eyes fell on me at the same time.
Is the mother sending for the child? Asked the albino's wife.
I saw the delivery, said Madame Augustin.
Then she is sending for the child, they concluded.
Suddenly a large hand was patting my shoulder. This is very good news, said the accompanying voice.
It is the best thing that is ever going to happen to you.
I could not eat the bowl of food that Tontati laid in front of me. I only kept wishing that everyone would disappear so I could go back home. Soon everyone began to drift towards their homes. On Saturdays, there was the house to clean and water to fetch from long distances, and the clothes to wash and iron for the Mother's Day Mass. After everyone was gone, Monsieur Augustin walked Tontati and me home. When we got to our door, he moved closer to Tontati as though he wanted to whisper something in her ear. She looked up at him and smiled, then quickly covered her lips with her fingers, as though she suddenly remembered her missing teeth and did not want him to see them. He turned around to look across the street. His wife was carrying some of the pots back inside the house. He squeezed Tontati's hand and pressed his cheek against hers.
"It is good news, Ati," he said. "Neither you nor Sophie should be sad. A child belongs with your mother, and a mother with her child."
His wife was now sitting on the steps in front of their bougainvillea, waiting for him.
"I did not think you would tell your wife before I had a chance to tell the child," said Tontati to Monsieur Augustin.
"You must be brave," he said. "It is some very wonderful news for this child."
The night had grown a bit cool, but we both stood and watched as Monsieur Augustin crossed the street, took the pails from his wife's hand, and bent down to kiss her forehead. He put his arms around her and closed the front door behind them.
"When you tell someone something and you call it a secret, they should know not to tell others,"
Tontati mumbled to herself. She kept her eyes on the Augustins' house. They had electricity. The main light in their bedroom was lit. Their bodies were silhouetted on the ruffled curtains blowing in the night breeze. Monsieur Augustin sat in a rocking chair by the window. His wife sat on his lap as she unlaced her long braid of black hair. Monsieur Augustin brushed the hair draped like a silk blanket down Madame Augustin's back. When he was done, Monsieur Augustin got up to undress. Then slowly, Madame Augustin took off her day clothes and slipped into a long-sleeved nightgown. Their laughter rose in the night as they began a tickling fight. The light flickered off, and they tumbled into bed. Tontati kept looking at the window, even after all signs of the Augustins had faded into the night. A tear rolled down her cheek as she unbolted the door to go inside. I immediately started walking towards our bedroom. She raced after me and tried to catch up. When she did, she pressed her hand down on my shoulder and tried to turn my body around to face her.
"Do you know why I always wished I could read?"
Her teary eyes gazed directly into mine. "I don't know why," I tried to answer as politely as I could.
"It was always my dream to read," she said, "so I could read that old Bible under my pillow and find the answers to everything right there between those pages. What do you think that old Bible would have us do right now, about this moment?"
"I don't know," I said.
"How can you not know?"
she asked.
"You try to tell me there is all wisdom in reading, but at a time like this, you disappoint me."
"You lied!" I shouted. She grabbed both my ears and twisted them until they burned. I stomped my feet and walked away.
As I rushed to bed, I began to take off my clothes so quickly that I almost tore them from my body. The smell of lemon perfume stung my nose as I pulled the sheet over my head.
I did not lie, she said. I kept a secret, which is different.
I wanted to tell you. I needed time to reconcile myself, to accept it. It was very sudden, just a cassette from Martine saying I want my daughter. And then, as fast as you can put two fingers together to snap, she sends me a plane ticket with a date on it. I am not even certain that she is doing this properly. All she tells me is that she arranged it with a woman who works on the airplane.
Was I ever going to know? I asked.
I was going to put you to sleep, put you in a suitcase and send you to her. One day you would wake up there and you would feel like your whole life here with me was a dream. She tried to force a laugh, but it didn't make it past her throat. I had this plan, you see. I thought it was a good plan. I was going to tell you this, that in 1 week you would be going to see your mother. As far as you would know, it would just be a visit. I felt it in my heart and took it on Monsieur Augustin's advice that once you got there, you would love it so much that you would beg your mother to let you stay. You have heard with your own two ears what everyone has said. We have no right to be sad.
I sunk deeper and deeper into the bed and lost my body in the darkness in the folds of the sheets. The bed creaked loudly as Tontati climbed up on her side.
Don't you ever tell anyone that I cry when I watch Donald and his wife getting ready for bed, she said, sobbing.
I groped for my clothes in the dark and found the Mother's Day card I had made for her. I tucked it under her pillow as I listened to her mumble some final words in her sleep.
Chapter 2.
The smell of cinnamon rice pudding scented the whole kitchen. Tontati was sitting at the table with a bowl in front of her when I came in. I felt closer to tears with each word I even thought of saying, so I said nothing. I sat at my usual place at the table and watched out of the corner of my eyes as she poured a bowl of rice pudding and slid it towards me. Breakfast rice pudding was a special treat.
Bonjour,
she said, waving a spoon in front of my face.
Your bonjour, your greeting, is your passport.
I kept my head down and took the spoon only when she laid it down in front of me. I did not feel like eating, but if I did not eat, we would have to sit and stare at one another, and sooner or later, one of us would have had to say something. I picked up the spoon and began to eat. Tontati's lips spread into a little grin as she watched me. Her laughter prefaced the start of what was going to be a funny story. There were many stories that Tontati liked to tell. There were mostly sad stories, but every once in a while there was a funny one. There was the time when she was a little girl, when my grandmother was a practicing Protestant. Grand-mère Ifée tried to show her Christian faith by standing over the edge of a snake pit and ordering the devils back into the ground. Tontati was always bent over with laughter as she remembered the look on Grand-mère Ife's face when one of the snakes started to crawl up the side of the pit towards her. My grandmother did not come out for days after that. Whether something was funny or not depended on the way Tontati told it. That morning, she could not bring the laughter out of me like she had in the past. It was even hard for her to force it out of herself. After I had eaten, I washed the dishes and put them in the basket to dry.
I want to tell you a few things,
Tontati said from where she was sitting at the table.
You need to know certain things about your mother.
Why can't you come to New York too? I interrupted.
Because it is not the time yet.
After you leave, I am going back home to take care of your grandmother. I am only here in Cour de Rosette because of your schooling. Once you leave, I can go back.
I don't know why you can't go to New York too, I said.
We are each going to our mothers. That is what was supposed to happen. Your mother wants to see you now, Sophie. She does not want you to forget who your real mother is. When she left you with me, she and I, we agreed that it would only be for a while. You were just a baby then. She left you because she was going to a place she knew nothing about. She did not want to take chances with you.
Tante Tatie opened the front door and let the morning sun inside. She ran her fingers along the grilled iron as she looked up at the clear indigo sky. She picked up a broom and began to sweep the mosaic floor.
My angel, she said, I would like to know that by word or by example I have taught you love. I must tell you that I do love your mother. Everything I love about you, I loved in her first. That is why I could never fight her about keeping you here. I do not want you to go and fight with her either. In this country, there are many good reasons for mothers to abandon their children.
She stopped to pound the dust out of the living room cushions.
But you were never abandoned. You were with me. Your mother and I, when we were children, we had no control over anything. Not even this body.
She pounded her fist over her chest and stomach.
When my father died, my mother had to dig a hole and just drop him in it. We are a family with dirt under our fingernails. Do you know what that means?
She did not wait for me to answer.
That means we've worked the land. We are not educated. My father would never have dreamt that we would live in the same kind of house that people like Monsieur and Madame Augustin live in. He is school teacher, and we, daughters of the hills, old peasant stock, petite soyette, ragamuffins. If we can live here, if you have this door open to you, it is because of your mother. Promise me that you are not going to fight with your mother when you get there.
I'm not going to fight, I said.
Good, she said. It would be a shame if the two of you got into battles because you share a lot more than you know.
She reached over and touched the collar of my lemon-toned house dress.
Everything you own is yellow, she said. Wildflower yellow. Like dandelions, sunflowers.
And daffodils, I added.
That is right, she said. Your mother, she loved daffodils.
Tante Tatie told me that my mother loved daffodils because they grew in a place they were not supposed to. They were really European flowers, French buds and stems, meant for colder climates. A long time ago, a French woman had brought them to Croix de Rosée and planted them there. A strain of daffodils had grown that could withstand the heat, but they were the color of pumpkins and golden summer squash, as though they had acquired a bronze tinge from the skins of the natives who had adopted them. Tante Tatie took the card from her pocket and put it on the night table next to the plane ticket. She said that it would be nice for me to give the card to my mother personally, even though the daffodil was gone. Chapter 3. The trip to La Nouvelle Dame Marie took a few hours in a rocky van. However, Tante Tatie thought that I couldn't leave for New York without my grandmother's blessing. Besides, Grand-Mère Fay was getting on in years, and this could be my last chance to see her. The van from Croix de Rosée led us off in the marketplace in La Nouvelle Dame Marie. The roads to my grandmother's house were too rough for anything but wheelbarrows, mules, or feet.
Tontati and I decided to go on foot. We walked by a line of thatched huts, where a group of women were pounding millet in a large mortar with a pestle. Others were roasting large cassava cakes in flat pans over charcoal pits. In the cane fields, the men chopped cane stalks as they sang back and forth to one another. A crammed wheelbarrow rolled toward us. We stepped aside and allowed the boys to pass. They were bare-chested and soaked with sweat, with no protection from the sun except old straw hats. We passed a farm with a bamboo fence around it. The owner was Man Grace, a tall woman who had hair patches growing out of her chin. Man Grace and her daughter were working in the yard, throwing handfuls of purple corn at a flock of guinea fowls. My mother had sent money for the reconstruction of her old home. The house stood out from all the others in La Nouvelle Dame-Marie. It was a flat, red brick house with wide windows and a shingled roof. A barbed wire fence bordered my grandmother's pumpkin vines and tuberose stems. I raced up to the front of the house to stand under the rooster-shaped weather vanes, spinning on my grandmother's porch. My grandmother was in the yard, pulling a rope out of her stone well.
"Old woman, I brought your child," Tontati said.
The rope slipped out of my grandmother's hands, the bucket crashing with an echoing splash. I leaped into her arms, nearly knocking her down.
"It does my heart a lot of good to see you," she said.
Tontati kissed my grandmother on the cheek and then went inside the house. Comme-y-fay wrapped her arms around my body. Her head came up to my chin, her mop of shrubby white hair tickling my lips.
"Are you hungry?" she asked. "I am going to cook only the things you like."
We ate supper on the back porch. My grandmother cooked rice and Congo beans with sun-dried mushrooms. She was wearing a long black dress as part of her day to mourn my grandfather.
"Tell me, what good things have you been doing?" asked my grandmother. "She has been getting all the highest marks in school," said Tontati. "Her mother will be very proud." "You must never forget this," said my grandmother. "Your mother is your first friend."
I slept alone in the third room in the house. It had a large four-poster bed and a mahogany wardrobe with giant hibiscus carved all over it. The mattress sank as I slipped under the sheets in the bed. It was nice to have a bed of my own every so often. I lay in bed, waiting for the nightmare where my mother would finally get to take me away. We left the next day to return to Croix des Rosées. Tontati had to go back to work. Besides, my grandmother said that it was best that we leave before she got too used to us and suffered a sudden attack of chagrin. To my grandmother, chagrin was a genuine physical disease, like a hurt leg or a broken arm. To treat chagrin, you drank tea from leaves that only my grandmother and other old wise women could recognize. We each gave my grandmother two kisses as she urged us to go before she kept us for good. "Can one really die of chagrin?" I asked Tontati in the van on the way back. She said it was not a sudden illness, but something that could kill you slowly, taking a small piece of you every day, until one day it finally takes all of you away. "How can we keep it from happening to us?" I asked.
"We don't choose it," she said. "It chooses us. A horse has four legs, but it can fall anyway."
She told me about a group of people in Guinon who carry the sky on their heads. They are the people of creation, strong, tall, and mighty people who can bear anything. Their maker, she said, gives them the sky to carry because they are strong. These people do not know who they are. But if you see a lot of trouble in your life, it is because you were chosen to carry part of the sky on your head. Chapter 4.
That whole week, Tonta T left for work before dawn and came home very late at night. She left me food to eat and asked Monsieur Augustin to stop by in the mornings and evenings to check on me. When she came home, I watched through the faint ray of light that crept across the sheet as she tiptoed over to our bed before going to sleep. That was how I knew for sure that she had not run away and left me. I went to school every day as usual. After school, I went into our yard and spent the afternoons gathering the twigs and leaves that kept it from being clean. When I came home from school Friday afternoon, I saw Tonta T sitting on the steps in front of the bougainvillea. When she saw me, she ran towards me and swept my body in the air.
"You cleaned up real good," she said.
I had done my last cleaning that morning before leaving for school. The dead leaves were stacked on top of fallen branches, twigs, and dried flowers. Tonta T kissed both my cheeks and carried my notebook inside. The living room seemed filled by the suitcase that she had bought me for the trip. While I was working on the yard, I had somehow told myself that I would be around for more potlucks, more trips to my grandmother's, even a sewing lesson. The suitcase made me realize that I would never get to do those things.
"I know I have not been here all week," Tonta T said. "I wanted to work extra hours to get you some gifts for your trip."
She poured hot milk from a silver kettle that she had always kept on the shelf for display. Stuck to the bottom of the kettle was a small note. "Je t'aime de tout mon cœur." I love you with all my heart. It was signed by Monsieur Augustin. I reached over to grab the note dangling from the kettle. Tonta T snatched it back quickly. She held it upside down and looked at it as though it were a picture, fading before her eyes. She turned her back quickly and placed the note on the shelf. We sat across the table from one another and drank without saying anything. I tried to hide my tears behind the teacup.
"No crying," she said. "We are going to be strong as mountains."
The tears had already fallen and hit my cheeks.
"Mountains,"
she said, prodding my ribs with her elbow. She bent and picked up a white box from the heap of things that she had bought. Inside was a saffron dress with a large white collar and baby daffodils embroidered all over it.
"This is for you to wear on your trip," she said.
My mother's face was in my dreams all night long. She was wrapped in yellow sheets and had daffodils in her hair. She opened her arms like two long hooks and kept shouting out my name. Catching me by the hem of my dress, she wrestled me to the floor. I called for Tonta T as loud as I could. Tonta T was leaning over us, but she could not see me. I was lost in the yellow of my mother's sheets. I woke up with Tonta T leaning over my bed. She was already dressed in one of her pink Sunday dresses and had perfume and face powder on. I walked by her on my way to the wash basin. She squeezed my hand and whispered,
"Remember that we are going to be like mountains, and mountains don't cry."
"Unless it rains," I said.
"When it rains, it is the sky that is crying."
When I came from the wash basin, she was waiting for me with a towel. It was one of the many white towels that she kept in a box under her bed for special occasions that never came. I used the towel to dry my body, then slipped into the starched underwear and the dress she handed to me. The suitcase was in a corner in the kitchen. The table was covered with white lace cloth. Tonta T's special unused china plates and glasses were filled with oatmeal and milk. She led me to the head of the table and sat by my side. A slight morning drizzle hit the iron grills on the door.
"If it rains, will I still have to go?" I asked her. She ran her finger over a shiny scar on the side of her head.
Yes, you will have to go, she said. There is nothing we can do to stop that now.
I have already asked someone to come and drive us to the aéroport. She took a sip from the milk in her glass and forced a large smile.
You should not be afraid, she said. Martine was a wonderful sister. She will be a great mother to you. Crabs don't make papayas. She is my sister.
She reached inside her pocket and pulled out the card that I'd made for her for Mother's Day. It was very wrinkled now, and the penciled words were beginning to fade.
I would not let you read it to me, but I know it says some very nice things, she said,
putting the card next to my plate.
It is not so pretty now, but your mother, she will still love it.
Before she could stop me, I began to read her the words. My mother is a daffodil, limber and strong as one. My mother is a daffodil, but in the wind, iron strong.
You see,
Tantati shrugged.
It was never for me.
She slipped the card in the pocket of my dress.
When you get there, you give that to her.
She will not be able to see the words, I said.
She will see them fine, and if she cannot see them, you read them to her, like you just did for me, and from now on, her name is Maman.
Chabin, the lottery agent, peeked his head through the open door, waving his record book at us.
We do not want to play today, Tantati said.
I am here to pay you, Chabin said. Don't you follow the results? Your number, it came out. You are a winner.
Tantati looked very happy.
How much did I win? She asked.
10 gold, he said.
He counted out the money and handed it to her.
You see,
Tantati said, clutching her money.
Your mother, she brings me luck.
The Peugeot taxi came for us while we were still at the table. I left Tantati's kitchen, my breakfast uneaten and the dishes undone. The drizzle had stopped. The neighbors were watching as the driver carried my one suitcase to the car. The Augustins came over to say goodbye. Madame Augustin slipped a crisp pink handkerchief in my hand as she kissed me 4 times, twice on each cheek.
If you study hard, you will have no trouble with your English,
Monsieur Augustin said as he firmly shook my hand. I held Tantati's hand as we climbed into the back seat. Our faces were dry, our heads up. We were like sunflowers, staring directly at the sun. Before pulling away, the driver turned his head and complimented us on our very clean yard.
My child, she cleans it, Tantati said.
The car scattered the neighbors and the factory workers as they waved a group farewell. Maybe if I had a really good friend, my eyes would have clung to hers as we were driven away. A red dust rose between me and the only life that I had ever known. There were no children playing, no leaves flying about, no daffodils. Chapter 5. The sun crawled across our faces as the car sped into Port-au-Prince. I'd never been to the city before. Colorful boutiques with neon signs lined the streets. Vans covered with pictures of flowers and horses with wings scurried up and down and made sudden stops in the middle of the boulevards. Tantati gasped each time we went by a large department store or a towering hotel. She shouted the names of places that she had visited in years past. When they were teenagers, she and my mother would save their pennies all year long so they could come to the city on Christmas Eve. They would tell my grandmother that they were traveling with one of the old peddlers, but that was never their plan. They would take a camion van in the afternoon so as to arrive in Port-au-Prince just as the sun was setting and the Christmas lights were beginning to glow. They stood outside the stores in their Sunday dresses to listen to the sounds of the toy police cars and talking dolls chattering over the festive music. They went to Mass at the cathedral, then spent the rest of the night sitting by the fountains and gazing at the nativity scenes on the Champs de Mars. They bought ice cream cones, while young tourists offered them cigarettes for the privilege of taking their pictures. They pretended to be students at one of the gentry's universities, and even went so far as describing the plush homes they said they lived in. The white tourists flirted with them and held their hands. They laughed at silly jokes, letting their voices rise and fall like city girls. Later, they made rendezvous for the next night, which of course they never kept. Then, before dawn, they took a van back home and slipped into bed before my grandmother woke up. I looked outside and saw the bare hills that bordered the national highway.
"We are almost there,"
the driver said as he slowed down. We waited for a while for the car to move.
"Is there some trouble?"
asked Tantati.
"There is always some trouble here," the driver said. "They are changing the name of the airport from François Duvalier to May Gate, like it was before François Duvalier was president."
Tantati's body tensed up.
"Did they have to do it today?" Tantati asked. "She will be delayed. We cannot miss our appointment."
"I will do what I can," the driver said. "But some things are beyond our control."
I moved closer to the window to get a better look. Clouds of sooty smoke were rising to the sky from a place not too far ahead.
"I think there is a fire," the driver said.
Tantati pushed her head forward and tried to see.
"Maybe the world... it is ending," she said.
We began to move slowly in a long line of cars. Dark green army vans passed through narrow spaces between cars. The driver followed the slow-paced line. Soon, we were at the airport gate. We stopped in front of the main entrance. The smoke had been coming from across the street. Army trucks surrounded a car in flames. A group of students was standing on top of a hill, throwing rocks at the burning car. They scurried to avoid the tear gas and the round of bullets that the soldiers shot back at them. Some of the students fell and rolled down the hill. They screamed at the soldiers that they were once again betraying the people. One girl rushed down the hill and grabbed one of the soldiers by the arm. He raised his pistol and pounded it on top of her head. She fell to the ground, her face covered with her own blood. Tantati grabbed my shoulder and shoved me quickly inside the airport gate.
"Do you see what you are leaving?" she said.
"I know I am leaving you." The airport lobby was very crowded. We tried to keep up with the driver as he ran past the vendors and travelers, dragging my suitcase behind him. As we waited on the New York boarding line, Tontati and I looked up at the paintings looming over us from the ceiling. There were pictures of men and women pulling carts and selling rice and beans to make some money. A woman shouted, "Madame," drawing us out of the visions above us. She looked breathless, as though she had been searching for us for a long time.
"You are Sophie Cacault?"
she asked, speaking directly to me. I nodded. Tantati looked at her lean body and her neat navy uniform and hesitated before shaking her hand.
"I will take good care of her,"
she said to Tantati in Creole. She immediately took my hand. "Her mother is going to meet her in New York. I spoke to her this morning. Everything is arranged. We cannot waste time." Tantati's lips quivered.
"We have to go now," the lady said. "You were very tardy."
"We were not at fault," Tantati tried to explain.
"It does not matter now," the lady said. "We must go."
Tantati bent down and pressed her cheek against mine.
"Say hello to your maman for me," she said. "You must not concern yourself about me."
The driver tapped Tante T's shoulder.
"There could be some more chaos," he said. "I want to go before things become very bad."
"Don't you worry yourself about me," Tante T said. "I am not going to be lonely. I will be with your grandmother. Just you always remember how much your Tante T loves and cherishes you."
The woman tugged at my hand.
"We really must go," she said.
"She is going," Tante T said, releasing my hand.
The woman started walking away. I moved along with her, taking big steps to keep up. I kept turning my head and waving at Tante T. Her large body stood out in the middle of the airport lobby. People rubbed against her as they rushed past. She stood in the same spot, wiping her tears with a patchwork handkerchief. In her pink dress and brown sandals, with the village dust settled on her toes, it was easy to tell that she did not belong there. She blended in neither with the smiling, well-dressed groups on their way to board the planes, nor with the jeans-clad tourists whom the panhandlers surrounded at the gate. She stood by the exit gate and watched as the woman pulled me through a glass door onto the runway leading to the plane. The plane was nearly full. There were only a few empty seats. I followed the woman down the narrow aisle. She showed me to a seat by a window. I slipped in quickly and looked outside, hoping to see Tante T heading safely home. I only saw a patch of the smoky sky. The woman left. She soon came back with a little boy. He was crying and stomping his feet, struggling to wiggle out of her grasp. She cornered him against the seats and pressed him into the chair. She held him down with both hands. He stopped fighting, slid upward in the seat, raised his head, and spat in her face. His shirt was soaked with the saliva that was still dripping from either side of his mouth. He rubbed his already red eyes with the back of his hand. Leaning forward, he pressed his face against the seat in front of him. It was almost as if he was trying to find a way to muffle his own sobs. I reached over to stroke his head. He grabbed my hand and dug his teeth into my fingers. I hit his arm and tried to get him to release my fingers. He bit even harder. I smacked his shoulder. He let go of my fingers and began to scream. The woman rushed over. She pulled him from the seat, raised him up to her chest, and rocked him in her arms. He clung to her body for a moment, then pulled away, digging his fingers into her neck. She stumbled backwards and nearly fell. He slipped out of her arms and ran out of her reach. She dashed down the aisle after him. A tall man blocked the aisle and stood in the little boy's way. He began to cry louder when he noticed that he was cornered. He jumped on a passenger's lap and began to pound his head on a side window. The man grabbed him and wrestled him back to his seat. He strapped him down with his seatbelt, then leaned over and did the same for me. As soon as his seatbelt was on, the boy sat still. Both the man and the woman stood over him and watched him carefully, as though they were expecting him to reach up and grab one of their eyeballs. He did nothing. He sat back in his seat, bent his head, and wept silently.
"What is the matter with him?" the man said in French.
"His father died in that fire out front. His father was some kind of old government official, très corrupt," she whispered. "Très guilty of crimes against the people." "And we are letting him travel?"
"He does not have any more relatives here. His father's sister lives in New York. I called her. She's going to meet him there."
"I can see why he is upset," the man said.
The plane began to roar towards the sky. I looked outside and saw the cars heading away. I could not tell Tante T's taxi from the others. The sound of the engine silenced the boy's sobs. He soon fell asleep, and shortly after, so did I.
Chapter 6
Children, we are here.
The woman was shaking both of us at the same time. The plane was empty. We walked down a long passageway, the woman first, with the little boy's hand in hers, and then me. She rushed us by the different lines without stopping. She only waved each time and flashed a large manila envelope. We soon joined a crowd and watched as suitcases filed past us on a moving mat.
"Do you see your bags?" she asked.
I saw my suitcase and pointed to it. She walked over and picked it up and put it on the floor next to me. We waited for the little boy to point out his, but he did not. She leafed through his papers and said, "Jean-Claude, do you see your suitcase?" He buried his face in her skirt and began to cry. She walked over and checked the stubs on the suitcases. He did not have any. We walked down another corridor. Then a glass gate opened itself, and we were out in a lobby filled with people holding balloons and flowers. Some of them burst forward to hug loved ones. A woman moaned as she walked toward Jean-Claude. She grabbed him and squeezed his little body against hers.